Scrunchy.
G'day, thanks to Vanessa from Banksia, and I'm Rob Jan, and welcome aboard the Starship Zero-G science fiction, fantasy and historical radio for episode number 1593, entitled Subterranean Liminal Spaces.
Ooh.
Our podcast title is Pod Sessions, and we would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands of the Wurundjeri, from which we broadcast from and to, and to elders past, present and future. Now, hello, Megan.
Hello, Rob.
King Midas and his ill-fated golden touch, the genie of the lamp and his conditional free wishes, false devil's bargain, and the monkey's paw, the be careful what you wish for cautionary trope,
yes,
is a custom fit for all manner of horror stories. It seems to make little difference whether your wish is well-meaning, self-serving, or just plain malevolent. The act of trying to rig things seems to be enough to justify things going very much pear-shaped. And rarely does it work out for the better, though there are some examples. And Megan has been off to see the latest in these exercises in wishful thinking.
Indeed, the latest and greatest film, Obsession, which has kind of become a big headliner, much-discussed film because of its sort of origin story and the fact that it's really taken the box office by storm. Mm-hmm. So Obsession has been directed by Kari Barker, and it's really very much his vision. He also wrote the film and edited the film.
Yeah.
And this sort of latest entry into the canon of which you speak, as you said, it really is kind of hammering the point home that, like, the outcome of the wish is in the heart of the wisher. And, you know, I think in addition to being part of the be careful what you wish for trope, it really falls under this umbrella of what I like to call incel horror films, which we've seen a few of lately. Most recently, I'd say I would draw some sort of similarities to the film Companion, which starred Jack Quaid. And that was sort of a AI girlfriend trope, but sort of as it went on, it's like, oh, okay, no, the man in this story is actually the antagonist of things. So I just wanted to sort of preface the review with that little note. But truly, this film, there's been a lot of discourse about it, and I don't really want to add too much noise to it, but I really, really enjoyed this film. I'm going to start off by saying that, which is why I really wanted to talk about it on the show. So Kari Barker has origins on YouTube, similar to another filmmaker that we're going to talk about later on Zero G today. So he has a channel called That's a Bad Idea, and it's sketch comedy, things like that. And this is kind of how he's been cutting his teeth on editing and telling stories. This is actually his second feature.
Right.
And Obsession, it is an indie film. So it was made, the budget for the film, and this is a figure it's been, everyone's talking about, it was made for $750,000. That is very, very, very low budget filmmaking. And it has now, I was sort of looking at the figures, it's changing over time because it's still in cinemas and still doing well. It's made Focus Features, who's the distributor, over $300 million at the box office.
I just passed on what you were saying there, $750,000.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And it's made, you know, X whatever times much that already at the box office. So it's also done this thing where it's seen, and there's been a lot of talk about this as well, this unprecedented growth over weekend. So usually, you know, your opening weekend is your big weekend, and then each weekend after that, you get less and less because it will just taper off. But word of mouth has meant that Obsession's actually growing its takings weekend on weekend. So
although the guy, the filmmaker, does say that if he had a wish, it would be that this film does well at the box office. So
well, there you go. I also think as well it's starting to gain titles of things like most profitable movie of all time. So it's already surpassed previous low-budget horror films like The Blair Witch Project and Paranormal Activity in terms of, you know, how much it was made for and then how much it's made. And I think a lot of this comes down to the fact that, you know, it's a fairly small cast, very contained locations, and a lot of the shooting and people working on the film, it was done in this very small way. It was a small project. So anyway, let's dig into it. Enough about its background, enough about the dollars and all of that jazz. As you mentioned, Rob, this film really is very much can be boiled down to nice guy, in inverted commas, makes a wish and chaos ensues.
So just to drill into that, We've got two settings for that. Is it a science fiction based wish or a fantasy based wish?
Love the question. So it's the latter. So it's supernatural. Okay. And what I actually like about the film is the way the wish is made, sort of the procedural and backstory of that isn't included. It's sort of to the side. We don't dig into all of that. It's very much just about what happens in this particular story for this particular guy who makes this particular wish. So who is the guy in question? Our nice guy in inverted commas. So his name is Bear. He works at a music store with a few of his friends, one of whom he has a crush on. So the object of his affection is Nikki. She's this kind of classic, pretty, cool girl. And in the glimpse of her, her real self that we see, she's, you know, she's fun, she's funny, she's relaxed. And we do get the vibe that, you know, she's friend-zoned Bear. You know, there's maybe not, you're not really sure about whether this crush is going to go anywhere. Anyway, one evening, the group heads to their usual trivia night. So this little friend group, so it's Bear and three other friends, one of whom being Nikki. But on this particular night, Bear is determined to share his feelings with Nikki. He's decided he's going to tell her how he feels at some point in the night. Much to, you know, kind of the chagrin, some of his friends have kind of tried to dissuade him a bit, et cetera, et cetera. You know, in his quest to reveal his true heart, he's also got sort of another thing up his sleeve. He's gone to a store, a mysterious store that has crystals and knickknacks and little tokens from the times past, one of which is this One Wish Willow. So he sees this One Wish Willow at this mysterious store, decides he's going to buy this, and this will be a gift that he's going to give Nikki.
Sorry, I get one wish, but what, willow?
Yeah, so this is the fabricated, this is the monkey paw, the kind of metaphorical monkey paw of the film. It's this little kind of stick in the shape of, kind of looks like a willow branch.
Ah, right.
And the idea is it's got this lovely little retro packaging, and the idea is you break it and you make your wish. And there's like a little jingle that plays as you pull it out of the box, and, you know, the person who pulls it out and breaks it makes their wish. The One Wish Willow will grant the wish.
Okay, because you can't say magic and shop and willow in one sentence without getting all Buffy.
Yeah, true. So, yeah, this later season Willow stuff. Poor Bear, you know, push comes to shove. Bear has his opportunity to share his feelings, but he's unable to tell Nikki because, oh, poor Bear, you know, he's so soft and sad and he just couldn't do it. So he's frustrated and he decides, oh, what the hell, I'm just going to break this One Wish Willow and I'm going to wish that Nikki Freeman loves me more than anyone else in the world.
So many potential paths for that to go wrong.
Yep. So, you know, for a while, it seems like he's gotten his wish. Everything he's ever wanted has come to fruition. Nikki is showing interest in him. They start to date. You know, Bear's like, whoa, can't believe this. But Nikki's behavior becomes more and more sinister and disturbing. And, you know, it does seem in the end that Bear maybe did get a little more than what he wished for.
Okay.
I'll leave it there.
Is there a sense that essentially he is rigging the game and he's compelling her to do something that she might not otherwise have done?
Absolutely. So you've really drilled to the heart of it right away, Rob, is kind of at the core of this film is the fact that the heart of his wish, like the core of it is he has wished, you know, to have his will over someone else's.
Oh, hence your comment about it being an incel horror movie.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, okay. And so I really have to call out, and I'm not the first one to do so, that the fantastic thing that makes this movie work is Indy Navarrete's acting as Nikki. So she's been kind of cast in this role of, you know, she's bringing a lot of the tension, a lot of the horror, in addition to some really wonderful lighting and set design that just kind of has this very claustrophobic and suffocating energy in what seems it should be, you know, spaces that should be cozy and welcoming end up being, yeah, just having this very sinister energy. And coupling that with a really standout performance from Indy Navarrete as Nikki, just like you see glimpses of the real Nikki behind this Nikki who is now, you know, Bear's girlfriend, the one who loves him more than anyone. And that is kind of what is bringing the horror of the film, and it becomes not like, oh, this is about a crazy girl. It's about, oh, the wish that he made is horrific. That is what is the sinister thing in all of this. And so the actor who plays Bear is Michael Johnston. He's also fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think the two of them have a really great chemistry in terms of, you know, the film's held together largely by the two of them. And like I said, I think it is a horror, so I would say there's some violence, there's scary bits. The way it's shot and the way it's made is meant to make you feel unsettled. I also think it just does so much with just the different sets. So one of the kind of core environments is Bear's apartment, and you know, a lot of stuff goes down in Bear's apartment. And just from looking at it, it's kind of this apartment he's inherited. He hasn't done much to it. It's this kind of little pokey space. But you can just tell, like, it's, you know, it's probably musty smelling. It just feels so dark. There's these shadowy corners. And, of course, you know, it's a great opportunity for Bach as the filmmaker to trot out plenty of scenes of Nikki, you know, hovering in dark spaces, you know, disembodied voices coming from places and that kind of thing. So the whole thing is meant to keep you on edge, but in a way where you're also, like, just going with this kind of thought that, oh, this is just such an awful situation for Nikki to be in. So it's very much not like Bear is the hero of this story.
See, some of the horror movies, they rely upon the gag of if you walk around the corner, there might be something there, and there's dread in that. This one, it sounds like the dread is in the setup.
It definitely is. And there's points towards, you know, we're getting towards the latter part of the film, and I'm like, oh, like he'll come home after a day at work and I'll be like, what has she done now? Like, I was worried. I was like, what has this Nikki done? Or, you know, what is he to expect walking in the door? And you are at the point where you're like, well, you know, it's things that, you know, he's wished for this outcome and this is where that has gone.
Michael Douglas, what's that movie? Indecent
Fashion? Yes, Indecent Proposal?
No. The bunny boiling thing.
Yeah, what is that movie?
Oh, my God.
Glenn Close.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Somebody will tell us right away.
Yeah. So, again, I think, you know, you could go in. I went into this with tempered expectations, but it truly did meet and probably exceed my expectations. I think the storytelling is fantastic here. I think the acting, like I said, Indy Navarrete, I just can't praise her enough for this. I think this is a defining horror performance. And, you know, there's comedy in there as well.
Fatal Attraction.
there's comedy in there as well to, like, cut the tension every now and then. But overall, kind of once things kick off, you are really just feeling this sense of this is not going to go anywhere good at all. I'd actually maybe draw some parallels a little bit to kind of the way The Exorcist handles horror, where, you know, there's some content, there's some gross stuff, there's this and that, but underneath it, there's this premise or this kind of parallel metaphor running underneath that you're just so engaged by.
Mm-hmm.
And it is disturbing, but in a very cerebral way, I guess, for lack of a better term. So, yeah, I can't sort of recommend it enough. I think, you know, there is, and I mentioned this to you, Rob, probably just a little bit of a warning on some pet unfortunate ending inclusions. I do think it fits within the story. And there's also a lot of kind of people have all these theories on Bear's cat and whatnot. But I don't think it's not distastefully done, but, you know, as often in horror, like a pet or something is kind of used as, you know, within the story as part of the storytelling.
You are giving us a heads up.
Yes. So very much giving you a heads up of that. But yeah, I think in terms of a discussion film as well, I think, you know, thinking about people's motivations and again, you know, you could be like, well, the One Wish Willow is evil, like an evil monkey's paw. And it's like, well, actually, I think it's about what the wish is.
Now, I'm just guessing here, but there's usually a point in one of these wish films where people try and reverse the film. reverses the wish. And I am thinking that the logical thing to do would be to get another one wish willow and reverse it. Is that covered in this film?
It is covered in the film. Okay. There's a little cameo from the director as well in the course of...
Is he the shopkeeper?
Not quite. Let's say Bear does a couple of different avenues of trying to... And that's sort of where the film very cleverly starts to drip feed you little bits of Bear, of you going, oh, no, like Bear's actually... He's not on the right side of things at all, which you sort of can tell from the beginning, but... Johnston really plays Bear as this very quiet, you know, he's so quiet and sweet and harmless, but he's really not harmless at all. So, obsession.
Frozen. Yeah. The prince in that is not.
Yeah. I think it's the nice guy trope. It's like nice guys aren't always nice guys for sure. So, like I said, another warning, yeah, there is violence, there's jump scares, but I think overall the approach, it's a pared-back horror, but very, very impactful. And at the core of it, I think, is a really clear vision that Barker's had of the story he wants to tell and how, and where each character sits within that story too. So, yeah, Obsession, directed by Curry Barker. There is a score, the score is by Rock Burwell. The other thing is, obviously, these actors, this is... For most of them, it's their big breakout. They haven't done a lot of projects before. The Rock Burwell, who did the score, it's sort of one of his only credits as well. I do have something from score, but I actually think I'm going to play a song that is kind of big in the marketing of the film. And it's not meant to be creepy, but once you've seen the film, it's a little bit creepy. This is the song Forever, and it is by the Little Dippers.
Hi there, I'm Jen Soska.
And I'm Sylvia Soska.
And we're the Twisted Twins, and you're listening to Zero G on 3RRFM.
Did you love it?
Was it good for you too?
Heck yeah.
That was Forever by the Little Dippers, used to great effect in the latest film from Curry Barker, the horror film Obsession, which I loved. I really felt that it was great. I saw it at the cinema. Everybody in the cinema was very involved. There was awkward laughs at points that were uncomfortable. The energy in the cinema was great as well. Like, I just really felt, oh, this is what it is to see, enjoy a film as a group experience. So, yeah, again, I thank you for people who texted in as well. Mentioned the film we were talking about, the Fatal Attraction film. And again, I would stress, I think on the surface you're like, it is a Fatal Attraction single white female kind of trope, but it's not. This is where we have to flip it and think from the incel horror angle, folks. But
gets under the skin of the bunny.
It does. Overall, I mean, people have talked a lot about, oh, it was made for not much money. Oh, the director's 26, blah, blah, blah. At the end of the day, all I want to be talking about is this is a great story done really well with some very, very fine acting. So, Obsession, head along. See it in the cinema if you can.
I see someone also texted in single white female, which is another good choice for that trope. I'm fascinated that part of it occurs in a music store, which means that the trope of the music store worker looking up and seeing his dream person going through the vinyl bins, his back.
Well, it's a music store for like instruments and things.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So, and that's the other thing, you know, there's some great production design around little 50s inspired or retro inspired stuff, like the shirts they wear at the music store and the One Wish Willow design. And I think because it's a smaller film, there's a lot of content around behind the scenes of the art direction, costume design and the little props and things and how they're all conceived. So I've enjoyed, because this is a thing where film I really like, I go deep on, and there's a lot of really great info on how this was sort of done creatively. A lot of there was makeup and things used to create uncanny effects in camera. So a lot of practical methods were deployed, which I love seeing. I love to see sort of this, scrappy approach.
Have you had any reflection, and this is probably too deep a question to ask, have you had any reflection about why this film affected you?
I think because I just think it was a really strongly told story. I think it was very well told. I also think the horror in it, like, you felt unsettled. I genuinely felt it in my gut. I felt, like, uncomfortable. Ah. And, yeah, I also think there's a part of the story where it is that note of, you know, here's this woman who has been very hard done by in this situation, even though outwardly she is the antagonist of creating this horrific situation.
This was done to her.
Exactly. And I think that's the discussion that is very good to be having in nuance. And there's a couple of scenes, there's one particularly upsetting scene where it really does hammer home, you know, the different things Bear's willing to overlook and his role in all of this. Mm. So I love that it's taking that crooked monkey paw trope a little bit further. And Aladdin, this is not.
I'm surprised he isn't played by, what's his name, Jesse Plemons.
Oh, but that's the thing. Like, Bear he has to be so innocuous. And Johnston plays him so well as someone who you're like, underneath all that, you are a nothing of a man.
Well, we now have two horror films, but they are both genre ones. I'm not really sure what Exit 8 qualifies as. I suppose because they don't explain it, it could be more fantasy than science fiction. But Backrooms is definitely on the face of things science fiction.
Mm.
And so it does get personal for me, these two films.
Yes.
So you can't always trace your fascination with a subject back to your childhood. But in my case, I actually found it easy peasy to do. My mum used to do some paid cleaning work at an agricultural college. Oh. And I went with her as a kid and was allowed to roam the empty classrooms and laboratories. Simpler times. Mm-hmm. And I had to make my own fun. So I expanded upon this experience later on by reading the works of professional fan fiction writer Philippe José Farmer, whose World of Tears saga featured adventurers stepping through portals into buildings full of booby-trapped rooms.
Mm.
Not bobby-trapped rooms, but booby-trapped ones. Often made more hazardous by sudden encounters with deadly opponents.
Mm.
And then there was the Gormenghast books set in a sprawling labyrinth of a mansion, which also Mervyn piqued my fancy, as did Tales of the Real-Life Winchester Mystery House.
Yes.
Which at its peak comprised 500 eccentrically planned rooms, now down to about 160, you know.
Oh, that's such a good, because, yeah, staircases that go nowhere, weird doors with nothing behind
them.
Part
of that was the San Francisco earthquake.
Ah.
But come to think of it, as it probably also explains why I've been drawn to the empty streets of post-apocalyptic fiction.
Mm.
And parallel to this, lifestyle and occupation led me to be a lifelong pedestrian,
mm-hmm.
which means that I was personally motivated, I had no choice, to transit liminal spaces, which is to say spaces that were frequently empty or at least sparsely populated when I passed through them.
Yep.
Some are unsettled by those spaces.
Mm.
To me, for various reasons, they're peaceful sanctuaries, almost like palate cleansers between occupied life and unoccupied life. And mostly they're non-threatening, which has occurred to me is probably an entitled male perspective. I don't see them as being potentially dangerous.
Yeah. What an evolved comment.
And liminal, by the way, is derived by appropriately squiggly pathways from the Latin word limen, which means of or pertaining to a threshold. So you have like the limits.
Mm.
And speaking of squiggly labyrinths, liminal spaces have their own niche on the internet.
Yes.
The uncanny valley of their familiar yet surreally empty volumes striking a popular chord.
Mm-hmm.
Most recently, it's sort of upswung, perhaps triggered by a post on 4chan, which showed a large vacant showroom space, empty but for seemingly random, oddly yellow-tinged walls and carpet, which was partly an artifact of the lighting, of course.
But what an impact.
It was called The Back Rooms, that post.
Yep.
And like many other quirky things on the internet, it had become a viral trend to post pictures of eerie liminal spaces online across all platforms.
Yep.
And I really do mean across all of them. part of a larger trend of so-called creepypastas. You can imagine, of course, how awareness of this trend accelerated during the lockdowns of the pandemic, during which, ironically, I was legally permitted to transit through a world, to RRR amongst other places for a while, through a world that seemed entirely composed of empty liminal spaces. Now, there's several films and television shows, episodes spinning off from the lore and legends around the Winchester House, Severance, for example, that is more directly linked to the back rooms.
Yeah.
There's more than one episode of Doctor Who, particularly set within the seemingly infinite interior spaces of the Doctor's TARDIS space-time ship.
Yep.
And The Shining, of course, has something to do with it, you know, big hotel, yep. empty spaces.
Yep.
And that Severance, it does actually directly cite the back rooms.
Yes, and you can tell from the design of the Lumen Industries that the back rooms and that concept of liminal spaces has been an inspiration there.
And there's tons of movies like The Cube, where people go through different torture spaces. and there it's obviously a standard trope in video games too.
Yes, absolutely.
Partly because it's easier to just do your walkthrough.
Yeah, yeah. It's like we don't have to code these little anything else in here to make it empty.
Yeah. You know, there's a game called The Stanley Parable, riffing off The Shining and Stanley Kubrick's sort of mono yellow spaces. You've got David Lynch's Twin Peaks.
Mm-hmm,
The Vivarium, that's a recent movie too.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Exit 8 and Back Rooms.
Yes. What a duo.
What a duo,
what a
yeah.
double feature.
I saw Exit 8 on streaming rental on Apple or Prime and Back Rooms at the cinema. You actually saw Exit 8
at the cinema.
At the cinema.
Which was I think there's something too about seeing something like this at the cinema, which should be, you know, can be a crowded space where you're all enjoying a shared experience, but could also be a very quiet, uncanny place to see a film like this.
Well, pretty much always for me, because I tend to go to the cinema in odd hours and sort of stuff, you know, Back Rooms, there was a fairly empty cinema.
That's kind of great though, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, the Exit 8, which is sometimes called Exit 8, as an indie adventure walking simulator game, which means you're walking through it, is set in and they came out in 2023, published by Kotake, and it involves the player going through a Japanese metro station passageway. And they get trapped in a loop in there, a time loop, not a city loop, but a time loop. And they have to keep trying to find anomalies within that space, which will enable them to finally exit the station. Short, long story short.
Yeah.
You've actually been at an Exit 8 in a Tokyo train station.
When I was in Japan recently, I sent Rob a picture of one of the subway lines. There was an Exit 8 and it was very quiet. There was no one else around, so I took my own little inspirational pick of an Exit 8. Luckily, I did make it out of there and made it home safely.
Or did you?
Well, I could still be there. This could it's be just a long FIFA dream.
So, yeah, there have been a few of those. The film itself, the film version, is directed by Genki Kawamura, Japanese director who did 100 Hours. He's a producer of some renown, a lot of films, like about 40 or so films produced. He did the body swap animated film Your Name.
I think the best body swap film that exists.
Well, that's saying something because there are a lot of them.
There are, and I think it's top.
Mm. Better than Freaky Friday.
touch better than Freaky Friday.
And there's another film, a more psychological film called Monster, which is one of his too.
Yeah.
Producer, screenwriter, author. He has a novel called If Cats Disappeared from the World, which is very popular. But no cats have disappeared from the world, although potentially they are. And he co-wrote the screenplay of the Exit 8 movie with Kentaro Hirase, who's a director, a writer, editor.
Yeah.
Did a film called Sai Juchang Ban. And that one has an interesting lead into this, in which four people lead ordinary lives in different places. Their paths never crossing, but eventually they kind of do, and there's a definite. And so I feel like there's a sort of a theme there that's echoed in Exit 8.
Yeah.
Which stars an actor called Kazunari Ninomiya, who's a Japanese singer, actor, presenter, radio host, practically everything. been in a boy band too. And he plays the lost man who's travelling in a crowded commuter train in a Japanese subway.
Yeah.
Everyone is on their phones politely but pointedly ignoring everyone else.
Yep.
They used to read manga. Now they're probably still reading manga but on their phones.
Yep.
It's creating a paradoxically populated liminal space if you stop and think about it. And our soon-to-be lost man, as does everyone else, ignores a bullying boar who snaps and yells at a mother who has a crying child on board the train, which I found really offensive, not having the kid on the train. But
His behaviour.
Yeah. Our man does nothing.
Yeah.
You know. While transiting the system, the lost man takes a phone call from his ex-girlfriend who was at a hospital.
Yep.
She has discovered she's pregnant and can't make up her mind what to do. And this is where, because it clearly interrupts his stream of
yes.
thought and his transit through the zone. And this is where our hero steps into the Twilight Zone mm-hmm. as he seeks exit 8 from the train station.
Yep.
Okay, so that's the setup for the film. Let's have a track from it. The soundtrack very strongly supports the story, and it is called Growl here, and it is done by Yasutaka Nakata.
Hello, I'm Ray Harryhausen, animation pioneer. You're listening to Zero G on 3RRR FM.
That was Growl by Yasutaka Nakata. And we played that from the score of Exit 8, which is the first film that we're tackling in our liminal space double feature today on Zero G. And the second film we're talking about in our, I guess, horror special show, having just wrapped talking about Obsession prior to this. So, yes, back to the underground, the depths of the Japanese subway system, which I think as well Exit 8 does such a great job of. Again, like you mentioned, it's sort of touching on this idea of urban isolation. Mm-hmm. And then again, also, I mean, you know, the subway system in Tokyo is renowned, especially certain stations, for being very difficult to navigate. You lose your way. You kind of lose perception of where you're at and unable to navigate through. And I think very obviously the film, and I'm fine with it being quite obvious, is, you know, laying this over a metaphor of being at a crossroads in life, or, you know, being combobulated.
Well, liminal also means crossroads and threshold.
Yeah.
And so it is a psychological thing, not just the obvious one of coming of age.
Yes.
But
yes.
The decision that our lost man has to make in this is that space as well.
And then, you know, I think even visually, just kind of the aesthetic of the film, the loop he's caught in is this infinity-shaped or eight-shaped loop.
Well, that's represented by an art exhibition poster on the wall of the subway tunnel for an Escher exhibition of Mobius Strip 2. They use the red ants on that, which is an infinite loop.
Escher would be loving all of this liminal space chat as well.
Oh, also they use Ravel's Bolero
yeah.
in parts of the soundtrack, which obviously is one of those, ostinato rhythms that doesn't change. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
it's all there for you to unpick there. other actors in this, and I think Kazanari does an excellent job as the lost man.
Yes.
He's vulnerable. He's plucky mm-hmm. as well, in mm-hmm. spite of the fact that he's got breathing
asthma,
difficulties.
Yeah.
Yes. So he's got some physical handicaps that are challenges that he has to face throughout this thing.
He's such a classic everyman, like, and, you know, there's definitely times where the film and the director is winking at you, like, I know you can see things here that our guy, the lost man, can't see. Hmm. So there's plenty of times where I feel like I'm in cahoots with the film and poor old lost man is just, he's not clicking, he's not no. getting it as fast as we are.
He is aided. It's not an empty liminal space. There are limited people that he does.
Very limited, yes.
Encounter. Yamato Kochi plays the walking man, and boy, does he walk. They even use that as part of a marketing campaign. They sent him the actor to New York and had him walk between subway stations.
That's cool.
It is cool.
Yeah.
And people recognized him instantly from the film.
He's got a great sort of, his face is quite distinct.
This is actually his breakout movie role. He's a Shakespearean stage actor before this. So this one, presumably still is. But he's great in this. He's got remarkable presence.
He adds another layer to the story too. So once you think you've sort of got a grip on it, it changes it up a bit.
Yes.
And you learn more a little bit about what this space is.
Naru Asanuma plays the boy, who is another key character.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Kotone Hanase playing the high school girl, the inevitable high school girl encountered mm-hmm. in these stories. And, of course, Nana Komatsu plays the woman, the pregnant woman.
The girlfriend, yeah.
Seen on mobile phones, basically.
Yeah.
And, well, yes, other circumstances.
Yeah.
So it's a very confined space sort of thing. You get to know the loop of corridors very quickly.
You're in it with him, yeah.
And the gaming aspect comes through too, except here's the difference between this and the game. We as an audience have no control over what he looks at. That's all on the camera.
Mm-hmm,
So we don't have really, I felt, the fascination that you had in the game of looking for the anomalies yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think I still was. I very much was. I felt like I was along with him. And I, like I said before, I think the film will show you things that it won't show The Lost Man.
Yeah. And to me, there was an aspect of what resources does he have? I'm trying to work the problem. There's no, unfortunately, there's no handy vending food machine and drinks machine, which could easily have been put in there. There's a trio of locked doors.
Yep.
That's useless. There's a wall phone that doesn't work, a fire phone. He's got his own phone, which you would think would be good for taking pictures of the anomalies and then working it out.
Not so much.
However... And there is the dread of not quite knowing what's around the corner, but not in the same way of, as Backrooms.
Yeah.
I thought it was a splendid little film.
Yeah.
I like the psychological dilemma that he has to work through.
Mm.
And in a way, that's the gaming part of it too, a reward or a punishment, depending upon how you play it.
Yeah. And I think as well, like, you know, it wears a lot of itself on its sleeve, like its ideas. Yeah. But at the heart of it, it's such a simple premise, really well executed. And it can be sometimes hard to manage like a repetitive style of story in a way that keeps you engaged. And I think, like I said, like it'll change it up. It'll kick to, you know, we'll get a bit of Walking Man story. And I think that keeps the interest there. I think it's pretty hard to pull off something like this. And I enjoyed it. I think as well, obviously, it just looks... You know, the look of being in the subway, you're very immersed. I was like in it with him, ready to go on the ride.
There's a funny aspect of this, which I've noted before in Japanese horror films. You know that moment in maybe The Grudge or The Ring, et cetera, where you have a perfectly curated Japanese apartment that suddenly is slightly disheveled.
Yeah.
And that's a horror moment. In this, it's kind of... It's like that because you've got this perfect, perfect subway.
Yeah.
Clean, sparkling, etc. The moment it stops being that, that's when the real horror kicks in.
Just a little bit of something turned horrific. Yeah, just...
Yeah, or a lot in one case.
Well, yeah, it kicks it up a notch towards the end, doesn't it?
It does.
Not quite the small details.
Look, there's lots of other tracks I could riff off to use to go out of this part, but... I'm going to go on a music video that was directed by the director of this film called Raison d'être, and this is by an artist called Eve.
This is George Romero, and I wouldn't be caught dead listening to Zero G on 3RRR FM.
That was Raison d'être by Eve, and... The good news, we've escaped Exit 8. The bad news, we've found ourselves in the back rooms.
which is a new horror movie, science fiction one, if we are to take certain events within the film upon face value.
I think there's some mystery as well, but sure, yep.
Directed and co-scored by Kane Parsons, a.k.a. YouTuber Kane Pixels, who is the composer, filmmaker and visual effects artist for Backrooms. I keep calling it... The Backrooms, but it's just Backrooms.
Well, it's because the short, the web stuff is called The Backrooms.
Yeah. So he saw the... So young.
I know, he's 20. He's 21 now, he just had a birthday.
Okay. Probably
so it's okay.
Not celebrated in The Backrooms. but he might have used a creepypasta cake to celebrate with. So, okay, he saw, that is Kane, saw the... Backrooms.
The image that we discussed.
Online said, you know, that really needs to be a film. Did a YouTube series of it. So I'm exploring it and actually literally exploring it. And now has this film out there which has grossed over 270 million worldwide.
A24's highest grossing film currently. So it's pretty big accomplishment.
He's also done some animated short fan films about Attack on Titan, which I'm not surprised by, actually. Okay, so that web series is obviously the one that brought him to the attention of A24 people.
Yep.
This is his directorial debut, and it's written by him and Will Sudik, who is known for working on Homeland, Ash versus Evil Dead, Borgia, and Westworld.
Okay.
So this is a really simple premise to start with and so complicated in the execution. Chiwetel Ejiofor plays Clark, a furniture store owner and a failed architect. I didn't really know that he was a failed architect. He does pretty well in mapping out back rooms in this.
Yeah,
we've seen Chiwetel before, of course, in Serenity, in the movie where he played the operative, Children of Men, Zephyr Zachariah, and he was Baron Mordo in the Doctor Strange movies, as well as a little strange sort of appearance. He was the voice of one of Sam's makers in Starfleet Academy.
Oh.
And he was also, most recently, I saw him in Old Guard 2.
He's fantastic in, I think he's great in everything he's in.
Mm. He plays the Clark as a person who's got anger management issues.
Yes.
He is still carrying the fact that he was supporting his ex-wife in law school by working in a furniture store. But something's fishy about that, I feel.
Yeah.
I think there were some unresolved things going on there.
There's some unsaid things that we can infer about, yeah.
Mm. And he's been seeing a therapist, Renate Reins, playing Dr. Mary Klein. Oh, there's a thing, a Klein bottle. That's complicated. She's a Norwegian actress.
She's the darling at the Cannes Film Festival. She's had a great run the last few years.
And appeared in one of my favourite authors' adaptations, John Lindquist's Handling the Undead. There's a film adaptation of that. There aren't a whole lot of other people in this film, and forgive me if I don't.
I think we can
delve into them. You'll find out about them as you go through. There are his employees and so on.
We've got some other people around, but
which you know, liminal space is sparsely populated. So basically, he's separated from his wife, or perhaps divorced, and is now living in the furniture store at night.
Yeah,
and there's problems with power outages. Electricians called in, can't really figure it out. Something is drawing a lot of power, but not the store itself. When he's exploring the basement, which is also part of the furniture store, more downstairs sort of thing.
Yeah.
He leans against a wall and falls through it, basically.
And
seemingly solid wall.
And then there he is in the back rooms.
In the back rooms.
Yeah.
Which, if you want to imagine it, I'll conjure up the picture, but you can Google it yourself. It's basically like a big furniture store without the furniture, with lots of seemingly random partitions.
Yeah.
Not quite as dense as a cube farm in an office building, but that sort of vibe, because in a furniture store you would have little fake rooms like IKEA. Yeah. Okay. And it's sort of yellowish, yellow walls, yellow carpeted floor. You can hear the
fluorescent lights. Very much like, also maybe a little bit like abandoned office space type of vibe. Mm. Definitely with that like pea-tinged hue over everything and kind of just doors that are a little bit funny shape or stairs that are a little bit going to nowhere.
And it's a weird space in many, many aspects, like that Winchester house we were talking about.
Not easy to navigate.
There are artifacts there. It's not just bare space. But some, there's like furniture, not from his store.
The artifacts make it more weird and confusing, not less.
Yes, because some of them have sunk partway through the floor and through the walls and the ceilings. Very much classic no-clip mode from gaming, if you're familiar with that. The cheat that allows you to pass through those normally impenetrable objects. Things get stuck in things like the Philadelphia Project. It's very uncanny valley.
Yeah.
Which is often used to describe hyper-realistic CGI humans in animated films. Ones are a bit off.
Yeah.
Which has become focused upon to a greater extent with AI.
With
six-fingered humans.
It's like you can tell something's not right. It's just a little bit unsettling despite its striving for realism.
Hmm. And in this movie you will find that there are distorts.
Yes.
What I call distorts represented. Oh,
and they are happy to make themselves known towards the end of the film.
Now, look, there are some dreadful things in this movie, what's around the next corner. Things half glimpsed quickly, shadows.
Weird recitings of different languages and sounds and whatnot that you can't quite place.
And when Clark flees back rooms because he sees something or he thinks he sees something, you know he's going to be drawn back into it.
Yeah, because he's not got much else going on.
No, he hasn't. And he's an architect, and I believe that that's leading him to map the space, which is way more than can be explained by just this is a sealed room in the back of the furniture store basement.
Yeah. Originally you could be like, oh, this is another room, but then it becomes quite clear that it's a weird space. It's odd. It's uncanny. It's unsettling. There's stuff here that shouldn't be here. Yeah.
There's a room full of discarded clothing.
Well, that was
that's reminiscent of the Holocaust, of course. And, you know, that's just that starts to make you think, wow, this is going places.
It gets dark.
Yeah. And you just, you know, it's one of those situations where you go, put a bookshelf in front of it. Go and call the police. Nobody's going to believe you.
Mm-mm.
But get other people involved.
Mm.
And that will happen because the therapist has got an interest in this.
Yes, Mary. Yep.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to tell you too much more about it.
We can probably, leave it there.
Mm. I think it's an excellent film. It's very disturbing, very unsettling. And the science fiction aspect is there. And it's a solid one. And it reminds me of certain films whose names I will not say because it will give too much away. Backrooms is still in cinemas at the moment.
Yeah.
Exit 8 has moved on mostly to streaming rentals and purchases.
Worth seeing both, and I think they are a great pairing.
Mm-hmm.
If you see both sort of similar time.
Both with good soundtracks too.
Yes. Yeah, the music in this is used to good effect.
And I think we should go out with a track from that, which will be People in San Jose from Backrooms, which is by Kane Parsons, the director, and Edo Van Bremen. I was going to go with the pirate shanty because Clark has cheapy sort of online and local television commercials where he plays a pirate.
Yeah, because his store's called Captain Clark's Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, because he can't quite work out the theme.
It's like, there's a line where he's like, are you a sultan or a pirate? Like, what's going on here?
Clark. So what have we talked about today? Obsession, Exit 8, and Backrooms. And we probably should be doing something nice next week.
Let's do something a little bit more uplifting. But for me, it's a solid yeah for all three of these films.
Maybe. I would say scare, yeah. Definitely for all three of those. Joe Brunatic is coming up next with Astral Glamour. And till next week, turn back.
Don't break that one wish, really. Just put it back in the box. Take it back to the shop.
Get your money back.
Get on with your life.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you, Rob.
G'day, this is Rob Jan. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Triple R's Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.